What I'll present tonight is not original. It's a good confession to make. Basically, what our hour will be is a book review. And the book is Whatever You Do, An Essay on the Christian Life, James Burton. And Jim has been on the faculty, I think, at Holden several times. And I don't know if this is being taped, but yeah. It is. If it is, if Jim Burton has ever come this and listen to this tape that is a review of his book. I'll start now by saying that one of the major points in his book is forgiveness.
You're reminding him of that?
Yes, I'm reminding him wherever wherever you are. And what I've done, I've turned his book into kind of the kind of game where you play, where you like you throw the dice and you go down and you get off on little side tracks and then you get back on the main road and then you finally go, and then this down here is start, this is finish, and we'll go through the outline of his book using this little chart. And for your help, each person gets an outline. This little chart here.
Looks like a picture of a plate.
Lime and beans.
fish in the middle there. Lime and beans. Walking over to Koinonia after dinner.
Right. And the fireplace is good.
Is this Burton's or Erlanger?
This is an outline of Burton's book.
Does he do it this way?
No, okay. He's never
Erlander.
He's never seen this. Okay.
There's some more?
Yeah, some more?
Yeah, there's some more.
This one's no good here.
Thanks, Jim.
Now, the other fear and trembling I have is the information that this chart went over was in my home congregation, was like a 5-week course we did in ethics, and like the first time we got to there and there and about there and there, and I'm going to try hopefully even in less than an hour to cover the material, and then hopefully I know we're going to cover the material in 45 minutes, have some time for discussion, and then this can also be a basis. I would like this to be a basis or in the back of our minds when we talk tonight in a forum on sexual ethics. So let us just plunge in and go down the line. The start. In a world where technology, mobility, and we've heard all of these words so many times describing our age, we almost get bored with them. Urbanization, industrialization, science, revolution, all of these forces that are upon us in the modern world make ethical decision making very difficult. And just quickly, two examples. At one time I heard a lecture on ethics, and this person had grown up in an Italian neighborhood in Chicago and said that when you did something wrong in the neighborhood, you were spanked twice. First by the person who caught you, and secondly by your own parents when you got home. And you see what that means about the old stable community where everybody agrees on the values. So you can, of course, anybody can spank anybody else's kids because you know exactly what their values are and you know your values are exactly the same. And he said when he moved away from this neighborhood, you know, how it was all changed. Would anybody here dare paddle the neighbor's kids? I mean, that's what? Good. Or not, maybe not paddle them, but to.
North? If they touch mine.
Yeah. But it's one example of our modern age's mobility. We do not grow up in these stable little communities where the values are shared by everyone. And the other, we could go on and on about technology, the ethical decisions that are forced upon us, that to our grandparents or to the Apostle Paul, would have been simply incredible. You know, the creation of life, what kind of life? In the old days, no sex before marriage because you will get pregnant and that will cause all kinds of trouble. You know, and the technology of the pill, how it's totally revolutionized what used to be a pretty good answer. You know, when everything else failed, you could at least say that one. We don't even have that answer anymore. That, you know, if we were doing a course in ethics, we'd spend the whole first time just sharing all of the influences of our age in which we live that make ethical decision-making very difficult. And what this drives us to is a tremendous insecurity. You do not grow up like in the old tribe or the closely knit community where you just know what is expected and know what is right and know what is wrong. So we live in a real insecurity. Now this causes us, or it forces us really to seemingly two possibilities, and then tonight we want to move into the third possibility. The one possibility is the security of absolute systems. And we could go on and on and on tonight about all the different types of absolute systems. Everything from, for example, sex, S-E-C-T-S, that have absolute demands on how you behave, absolute rights and wrongs, or also very conservative churches that offer the security of telling you exactly what is right and wrong. The Bill Gothard system, you know, come buy a notebook and it'll tell you exactly how to live as a family. Okay, that is one way to move from the insecurity of the modern world. The other direction to move is, that's the other direction there, absurdity. You know, life really is a joke. There is no values of right or wrong. So it's really an attitude then of giving up. Or just saying it's all relative anyway, so why bother? You know, and this again can lead in so many, many different directions. So what Jim presents in the book then is really the third alternative. And that is to move into the area of Christian ethics. And notice right away we've said it's neither of these. And especially it is not the absolute system. Okay. Then Jim has us in the book now for a while just leave behind the whole question of ethical decision making in the modern world. And has a very beautiful explanation of the gospel. In the relationship of gospel and life, or the good news and the way we live. And he brings out and explains four different ways to approach the Christian faith. Faith and life equal being a Christian. Faith equals being a Christian, and the life is an expression. Life equals being a Christian, or faith equals being a Christian. I'll start with the bottom. Faith equals being a Christian. This would be basically Bonhoeffer's cheap grace. As long as you believe the right doctrines. Belief here is an assent. If you believe the right thing, it really doesn't make any difference how you live. Okay, the second would be life equals being a Christian. Being a Christian is a person who's good. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you act right. Then the top one is faith and life equals being a Christian. This is one traditionally Lutherans have really been afraid of because they've been so afraid there isn't the proper separation between faith and works. And in the context here, it means that you're finally accepted as a Christian when your life is, or your faith is proven by your works. Then what the other one then is, faith equals being a Christian is a gift, and one's life, ethical life, is an expression of that gift. Now this is the this is what Jim Burtness would say is has been the Lutheran answer to faith and life. Faith is being, in other words, we are Christian by simply trusting grace, which is a gift, and then our Christian life is an expression of that gift. Jim has a beautiful pages in here about the only unique thing about the Christian faith is gift. Simply is receiving the gift. Then he's very cautious then, and that's when we move into this next little circle.
Dan, before you go to that, did he give any examples of the top one, faith and life equals being a Christian?
Yeah, I wasn't sure of that, so I went back and looked at it today and wasn't really sure. Because I don't see that much difference between that and, you know, when he's explained this, he almost ends up here.
Yeah.
And so my assumption would mean is that you, you know, you really cannot sense an acceptance until you've spent a lot of time proving it, that your faith is active in love. Rather, well, let's see where he ends up. And I really agree. It's so close that I'd almost put a question mark by that.
It seems to me it'll make a big difference
mm-hmm.
down the line, though, the way it's talked about.
Mm-hmm.
That has to influence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been the very traditional kind of Lutheran fear that somehow these two get too connected. We've been so insistent that they be separated. And so what he does then is really put out a paradox. He says that in Lutheran theology, faith and life must be at the same time distinctive and also at the same time inseparable. Distinctive and inseparable. And
in the world, not of the world kind of thing.
Hmm?
In the world, but not of the world paradox.
Yeah, I'm not sure to be the exactly in the world paradox. He makes a real point that to at the same time connect these completely and at the same time separate them. But, I think this would be a fascinating just to stop at this point sometime for a whole evening.
Dan?
Yeah.
Also, before we move on, in that prior one there, the word faith does not mean, as you expressed it anyway, does not mean the same thing in each case.
Yeah, it kind of wavers.
It moves around a bit. Mm-hmm. And so part of the problem then is to using the same word.
Mm-hmm. Are you using
faith means believing in the right doctors, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If faith means trust, which he shows it to be next, that's quite a different thing.
Yeah, that is part of the problem there is you're dealing with the word faith, and when you come out with these different conclusions, you have to go back and realize you're meaning different things, like faith, you know, faith has to be the trust faith that includes works, or else it's not faith. You know, well, when you go down to the bottom, faith equals being a Christian, then he's talking about what, as we've said, Bonhoeffer talked about in terms of the cheap grace. Yeah. But let's move on from that, and really, if we could just kind of set that on a shelf for another discussion, because it's critical. And I think in just a little I've read and listened to tapes on Yoder that might be the real that might be the real question he asks of us as Lutherans. You know, am I right on that?
Mm-hmm.
That might be his real challenge, you know, that we've been so concerned about separating them that we've moved into the area of cheap grace just as a way of keeping our doctrine pure. Okay. So let's move on. Now, the next is important distinction. Well, I'll say one more word about this. That let's emphasize now that faith here, we're talking about not an intellectual assent, but we're talking, right now we'll define it as this, is a trust, it's a radical trust within a relationship with God. And hopefully as we move up the chart, what that radical trust will emerge and be defined. And then the little hook there going through the two holes is Jim Burtness's just strong statement that it is impossible to be given this gift of trust, which is a gift received, without it being also the gift of the life, of the Christian life, or the life of work. No way. If you pull these two apart, you no longer have the trust. Okay. Moving along. Now, the next is where we make an important departure, I think, between what I think is traditional Lutheran teaching and what possibly most other Protestants might say. One thing, part of the whole Protestant principle is that we're, quote, saved by grace through faith. Okay, now, possibly most Protestants would say, yes, the Christian life, acceptance, salvation is totally a gift, and the Bible teaches us that it is a gift. Okay, then, what the Bible then becomes is a rule book that tells us how to live the life that flows out of that trust. Now, I don't know if you get Billy Graham's daily little article in your local newspaper. And we have in Albuquerque every day in the paper, there's a column by Billy Graham called My Answer, or The Answer, or something. Is it called My Answer? Mm-hmm. And then there's always a question. And there's always a question that somebody has written in. And then almost, if it's ever a question about ethics or how to live the Christian life, invariably the answer will be a quotation from the Bible on what the Bible says orders you as a Christian on how to live in terms of that area. And it's funny to follow, you know, one won't go into that, but I just, do you understand what the principle is?
Do it again.
Yeah, okay. Okay, the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Okay, the New Testament explains to us that we are a child of God totally as a gift of God's grace that we receive by faith. Probably very few Protestants would deny this. It's just the Protestant principle. Okay, then whatever the New Testament says then on how to live the Christian life, anytime there's a rule there, then that is the absolute guide for the absolute law on how the life of faith is lived out. For example, then you would say, what does the New Testament say about how families are supposed to live together? What is the divine law about how a father should behave? So you go through the epistles, the gospels, wherever you can find. Okay, what does the New Testament say about marriage and divorce? Okay, you go through the New Testament until you find the rule about that. And then those become a law that you assume as your response to grace. Is that clear yet?
Does he ever stumble over situations like genetic engineering or something like that? Where it might be difficult to find a reference that you could clearly refer to the question?
One, nobody ever writes questions like that. that I've ever seen.
Or if they do, they probably touch it away for
future. Yeah.
Maybe he writes all the questions too.
One of the really almost unbelievable answers was somebody wrote asking a reconciliation to turn the other cheek to America being involved in the Vietnam War. You know, and Billy Graham actually is very interesting. He said that law was only given to the disciples. It was only given to the first disciples.
Yeah,
but now there's.
Does the Yoder talk about that quite a bit in this book?
No. And Graham has changed considerably on the arms race. I don't want to slow you down because I know you're trying to do this in one session. Very frankly, what you just outlined as a dead end is so close to at least what's taught in catechism that the subtlety is beyond. I'm just telling you. Grace, saved by grace, and our New Testament guide, as far as law is concerned, is a guide to how we respond. Not that we get saved through it, but it is response. And the law is regel, regel, and spiegel, according to good Lutheran German mirror, guidepost, and yardstick or something. So I'm not...
Okay.
All right. It would not be a dead-end street in the simplest kind of explanation of the place of the law in ethics, I don't think. But.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
Hopefully, and this is what I hope in the arrows coming down at the top, we'll come back to just being extremely close to this.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's how I've worked it out, that it's maybe a subtle difference. Oh. Yeah. The I think one way to make it clearer, we might we might be dealing here with for example, Pauline, the man is the head of the wife. Okay, if you say this at this point, now you have to say that's an absolute law now for living the Christian life. See. Or a woman should not be allowed to speak in the church. Then that becomes, you write down all of these laws, and then they become the absolute way that one will live the life which is a response to grace. I don't know if that makes it any more, as I'm trying to struggle to understand it here. Okay. Yeah. What we're really talking about is literalism in terms of the... And the danger we're running at every point here is in the system that we're following. Every point there's a possible kind of way to cop out. This is very dangerous.
The danger of picking and choosing what you're going to be learning about or not.
Yeah, the danger or the danger of not taking the radical demand of the gospel seriously. And we have to recognize all along that danger. Okay, let's see. Where do we go now? This is the point that, as I understand it, Jim then makes, is it unlike this first, that the living out of the Christian life, which is a trust life, what determines that is not a law code ethic, but what he calls a radical trusting obedience. A radical trusting obedience. And it really means that at this point, my identity as a child of God that has been received as a gift of grace, given in baptism, places me, and we can't put this any stronger than it places me in a master-slave relationship. Or in freedom, I choose this. And I don't know how you could get more radical in the demand. What else I have. The claim of baptism the claim of unconditional love is unquestioning, total slavery, discipleship, obedience. Okay, again, the reminder with just this little arrow going off the top is that this, again, must be separated from absolute principles. But where we are at the point now in the chart is we have been claimed by a personal God, the response of life, or the life that is the trust, is not a following of absolute principles, but rather it is an absolute loyalty to a person. Is the distinction between those two now clear? The easiest probably, only it doesn't completely follow, but the easiest is often a marriage relationship. But I mean, in marriage it isn't the same. You don't have master and slave. But the life within the marriage is not based on absolute laws and how a marriage should be. You know, I still haven't met a married couple where just before the wedding they sat down and wrote out all of the principles that each would follow in order to love. But it comes out of an absolute commitment, you know, a total commitment. And it doesn't quite fit, but it gives you a little idea about the difference.
By absolute principles, do you mean the same thing with the literalism you're talking about in the lower?
Yeah, okay, that somehow you would be able to open up the book and, for example, abortion would be one, and then you'd have the absolute law about it being right or wrong. Okay. Now our next thing that he deals with in the book is that what this leads us into is if we move away from the area of absolute laws, we are thrown into what society and modern society has defined as situational ethics. You know, we're there. So then we have to talk about where we are in terms of situational ethics. And he talks about several different kinds. One is a situational, now maybe we should just define briefly what we mean by situational ethics, is that it's ethics that are at least somewhat determined, rather than by an absolute law, are somewhat determined more or less by the situation or the life event or the relationship in which one finds herself or himself in a particular moment in time. One is the situational ethics of do what you feel or think or know is right. And this could be all the way from a very personal hedonism, you know, whatever feels good for me, to a very enlightened hedonism, that I will act in a way that produces the most pleasure to the most people. Very enlightened hedonism. That would be one way. What I feel from all my experiences right in a certain situation, really depending on my values, that I will do. Okay, the other is, and again, the distinction between this and what he's talking about, again, gets complicated, but not a situational ethics of doing a loving thing. And here he's talking about what was Joseph Fletcher's book, Situational Ethics. Is the right thing to do in a situation is the most loving thing to do. What the loving thing to do, according to Joseph Fletcher, is what will enhance another life. I have a problem here because in a way where he ends up isn't that different. But let's look at the difference. Did anybody read Fletcher's Situational Ethics? When I when I read that, I think back in seminary, I assumed this man must be the most radical looking person you've ever seen. If you had a picture of him as this wild fellow. Chicago once, I heard him lecture, and we were all waiting for Joseph Fletcher to walk out onto the lecture platform. And he finally came here, was this sweet, kind, grandfatherly, gray-haired, gentle man of about 70, who had probably the most beautiful grasp on the English language I've ever heard. But that was this man that had caused so many to think that the church had really gone far off. Jim Burness is afraid of situational ethics of love because his claim is, if I'm interpreting him right, is that if we say do the loving thing, all we're doing is taking all the absolute laws and pulling them down to one absolute law. And that's the law of love. I'm not sure about this one either. James talks about the law of liberty.
It seems that both of those two originate in my judgment of the situation. I decide what the loving thing is, or I attempt to determine what it is that I feel or think based on my study of the situation or my own awareness of the situation. It all seems to originate in myself. That seems to be a difference between those two spurs and what he's got there, which is something based on something outside of myself. Mm-hmm. I trust their loyalty beyond me.
If Joseph Fletcher, I don't even know if he's still living. I think if he were here, he would really deny that comes. But I think that's what Jim Burton's is afraid of. Either it becomes another law, or it's the individual that decides what is the loving thing. Jim Burtness refers to this in his book, that two teenagers in the back of a car on a beautiful evening, it's all very easy at that point to decide what is the loving thing. Doesn't take too much thinking.
The classical case, I think it's another example of Lutheran paranoia, really facing the question of situations. The classical case in the book in Fletcher always uses is the woman who is in a concentration camp and whose family is another place. She's been interred and taken away from her family, and the guard offers to let her go if she will have intercourse with him. What does she do? What is the right thing to do? What is the best thing to do? What is the ethical thing to do? And I think that's a more realistic situation. I think Burton stacks the deck. Because you're afraid of the situation. And
yeah.
I think if you really get some tough nut questions, which I think in some cases Fletcher does, I think you've gotten an awful lot of bad press, largely from Lutherans. I think he was doing a very important thing, reacting against the kind of prescriptive, kind of I have the answer automatically, or the Bible always has the automatic answer. Unfortunately, he hasn't gotten much. Plaudits for turning the whole, I think he turned the whole ethical debate around, frankly, and said we have to take seriously what's going on rather than just coming with a rule book and prescriptions from the church.
Unfortunately, the press put him just next to Hugh Hefner.
Right.
Which is a total, which is.
If you look at love as being, the love of God, and that God is love, and love your neighbor as yourself, and that kind of view of loving, I don't see how that is different than, there is something probably, but if it's through a relationship in Jesus Christ that you're deciding these things, isn't that the same thing as deciding the thing on if it's the loving thing to do?
Yeah, I think.
You try to look at love as being not what gives a person pleasure or ends up the best, but just what right then, in your after asking God, what he says to do.
Probably if there is a fear that's in this book that talking about the law of love has a possibility of separating it from what we would normally call the covenant relationship. you know, again, making it in a statement, you know, rather than in a living type of relationship. The other thing that might be unfair, you know, about this is that, you know, this book is 15 years old. I think if Jim Burtness were here tonight, he might argue with himself. You know, how many of us think the same thing as we did? I hope none of us do. Oh, so, well, be interesting to hear him argue with himself. What? What's that?
I wondered what he was thinking 15 years ago on it.
Yeah, what were you thinking? What was your ethics 15 years ago? Okay. Now, okay, so again, we're he moves from these two alternatives, again, back to what is a very personal covenant relationship wherein I am claimed, and out of that claim, my life is one of trust and loyalty. And we'll use the word more loyalty, which again means that I'm the servant. God, whom I know in Christ, is the master. Okay. Then the next thing Jim Burtness has us work through in this book, and at this point, if you're not ready for this, it can become very devastating. In fact, when we went through this course in my home church, we had to spend a whole session on this point because some people at the end of this part were really devastated. You know, as a point now, what is there left? So I'm going to give these four kind of devastations. Okay. Okay. We, even if there, for now here Jim Burtness takes very seriousness what we've all always talked about is sin, not as act and deed, but sin as condition. Sin as a state, or sin as a condition rather than individual deeds. He said, even if absolute principles existed somewhere out in space that had been set and actually written into the very reality of the universe, even if there were absolute principles, there'd be no way we could know them because our knowing them would be so tainted by our condition of rebellion. So even if you say there are laws out there on how we should behave, there's no way that our mind could even hear these. And then, very close to that, if sin is a condition, the old idea that God has a plan for your life, whom you will marry is chosen, God has a plan, he has it plotted out, what your job should be, what your occupation, where you should live, whether or not you should come to Holden. Even if God had this plan of your life worked out somewhere, there'd be no way you could ever even know it. Again, because of our sinful condition, our hearing. Even if we had a direct telephone line and God had this planned out, our end of the receiver is too jammed up. So number one is the denial that God even has this kind of a plan for you, and if God did, there's no way you could find out about it anyway. And this is an extremely popular idea. You know, God has a plan for your life. If you pray and listen and do the right things, you can find out this plan, and then if you do that, then you will have peace in your heart. Have you heard that? You'll be at peace. Here I mean the normal use of the word personal, inner peace. Okay, so there's about, no...
How about a slight... tell me what the difference between that and someone who says, whatever happens in my life is the will of God.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the next little line. We'll move to that. Okay. I can read this here. Since the world is fallen, you know, the biblical understanding is that somehow all of creation is out of order. That sinfulness, the sinful condition, has not only affected us, it's affected all of creation. Therefore, we cannot say that whatever happens is the will of God. You know, some cling to that, well, if it kind of, my life kind of works out this way, that's the will of God. And again, Jim Burton would say no, because you're messed up, the world's messed up. And then we have one more out that we could cling to an absolute social structure that would tell us what to do and how to behave. You know, okay, there are no absolute laws floating in the air that I can know. There's no will of God and plan for my life that somehow I can find out so I can do it and have peace. I cannot say that whatever happens is the will of God, so why don't I just go along with that and accept it as His will, because creation itself is out of whack. But at least I can find an institution that will tell me what to do and how to live. A state, a government, some other institution, a race, a culture. You know, I can at least cling onto that.
Church, commune.
What?
Church or commune.
Sure, church, commune, anything. And then I can turn my life over to that. You know, again comes the big no. And he shows how it was, Reinhold Niebuhr was the one that really showed us that, in a way, collective sin is worse than individual sin. Did you ever see a Kiwanis Club down on its knees repenting for its collective sin? Anybody? They always have a chaplain, but they never have a confession. Or a Rotary Club. So what, when I've honestly dealt with these four now, where I come out is in the realization that I live in a very, not a very, I live, I just plain live in an ambiguous world. I live in a gray world. I live in a world where there's nobody that's telling me exactly what to do, and even if they did, my condition would make it impossible for me to hear it.
And the thing situational ethics takes, the thing not following situational ethics takes away from you is being assured that what you think is the loving thing and what you think is right is right. You can no longer be assured of that.
Yeah, there's never any way to know. And we could spend a lot more time, but I want you to grasp a little kind of the possible despair at this point. And he does this in the book. He wants to take all your little crutches and just whack, 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 whack. You know, and then you're in a puddle on the floor. Now this was a Sunday when we lost 50 members. They went down the street. To the Happy Land Community Church.
Melody Land.
Melody Land. Okay, now where he wants us to understand then when we felt this ambiguity is to realize the difference between living in ambiguity and living in absurdity. An absurdity would define as there's no way to know, there's no way to understand, and therefore there's really no meaning. So I'll have to find, you know, then, I don't know, maybe you could help me define what it would mean by absurdity. If life is so gray, it's either a bad joke or a cruel game.
You mean like there's no way to know, so it doesn't matter what I do anyway?
Yeah, that might be one way to end up.
I think it implies chaos, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Whereas ambiguity at least implies the possibility of seeing an arrow with a point on each end. Mm-hmm. In some direction, I think.
Well, let's pull our, no, we can't pull ourselves out of this puddle. No, this will almost sound too Lutheran. God does. But let's look at where we move after the help. It's only now when I realize the total ambiguity of my life in the world that I begin to move into the meaning of trust or loyalty. That in the midst of the grayness of never knowing, it is at that point that I trust the relationship, I decide to be loyal, and then I move out in a life of risk in the context of the living relationship. Now, the four arrows at the top. Now, what then, for as I understand it, Jim Burton has come out is that living the life of absolute loyalty and absolute trust is to, one, figure out the best you can how God is acting in the world to move the world to shalom, or to the redeemed creation, the kingdom of God, for the whole world is a unity, all of creation is a whole, united in Christ. And what he makes a distinction here that comes from Bishop Robinson, that God is not the God of the rock that's on the edge of the stream, but God is in the stream. God is working in history. This is history affirming. God is working in history, moving his whole creation to the unity of shalom. Okay, the life of absolute loyalty to God's revelation in Christ is then to take my place in the God action that is in history as the world flows to God's ultimate goal, which is shalom. And then he has, what he lists then are the helps or the tools that we have given to us in living this life. I like to call it the life of the flow. You know, you jump into the water of life and move where God is moving. Okay, the first is the gift of forgiveness that gives me permission to act and to live with others. In other words, you jump in and know if you're wrong, there's forgiveness. And that provides the freedom from having to be right before one jumps in to enter into the flow of God working in history. Okay, now the big question is, how do I know where God is working in history? I don't know. But forgiveness gives me the freedom to guess and then jump in on that guess. Now, this is where then we move back to Scripture, to the Bible. That the words of Jesus, for example, the Beatitudes, by reading them, we know where God is moving in the world. We're sensitized. Or the Eucharist. As bread is broken and people are united, we are given a picture of where God is moving in history. Okay, then the tradition of the Christian family. Part of the tradition of the Christian family is the Ten Commandments. Part of the tradition of the Christian family is, for example, strong prohibitions against sexual intercourse outside of the context of a covenant relationship between two people. You know, the Christian family has worked on this for centuries. You know, and we have all our brothers and sisters in Christ through the years who passed down this understanding. Not as law, but, oh, this is the way we figured it out. You know, try it some other way and see. Grandfather says, or great grandfather. Does that, you see what I mean by, and it's very close also, right, to the wisdom of the church. And this is a collective wisdom of the church, This is the ALC or the LCA making statements about sexual ethics. This is a collective wisdom of the church. Now, I hope in this that we see where we move back different, but yet very close to where we were here, that we look into the scriptures to see what, for example, in Jesus' teachings, what he describes as the meaning of absolute loyalty. I don't know, does that clear how we've moved back very close, but not where Billy Graham was? I don't know where Billy Graham is.
Dan, when you started to say that everything here is sort of a flow to the kingdom, right away my reaction, you know, I think about people saying, well, doesn't make any difference what path you take to God. We're all going to the same place or something like that. And I think that the significance of this is that it all comes after that hell, which is sort of, I think, a reaffirmation of dying with Christ in baptism. It's total surrender.
Yeah, the baptismal union is really being connected to this movement, God's movement in history towards shalom. Yeah, I'd like to close, and I'm always guilty when there isn't a lot of discussion, but I'd like to assume that our forum tonight will at least partly be a reaction, or this will be somewhat the context of. I'd like to I wrote down a few sentences about how this might relate to the topic of what's often called what, sex before marriage, sex outside of marriage, sexual intercourse before or outside of marriage. When we start with God is at work moving his whole creation to shalom, and then move from there very quickly, is a sexual relationship to another person is, I think we would agree, my relating to another person in the closest of human intimacy and vulnerability. Okay, now, in terms of personal relationships, in absolute loyalty, I have to see God is working in the life of the person next to me or with me to move that person towards the fulfillment of all creation. If God is moving that person towards the fulfillment of that life, just as a flower comes out of the ground and moves towards its completion. Okay, the most intimate and vulnerable of human relations has the fantastic and tremendous possibility of either helping that person move towards this goal of shalom for her or him, or by exploiting as a possibility of really breaking that flow of that person. Now, at this point, I'm willing, and we can talk about this later, but I'm willing to really take very seriously the wisdom of the ages, that when that type of intimacy and vulnerability, first, before I say that, is that it's important that we start talking in terms of the difference between fulfilling another person or using another person, whether it's inside of marriage or outside of marriage. Sometimes we get trapped in the law of that one ceremony. But, you know, the wisdom of the ages has, you know, just been very clear about the possibility of not helping or endangering a person's flowering of life if the intimacy of sexual relationships take place outside the trust of the covenant commitment. Notice I'm not at this point saying marriage. You know, that would be a further discussion. I'm saying a covenant commitment. And that it's at that point that we have to start asking the question. And the further question, before marriage, I'm just raising the question, when the covenant commitment is celebrated, and is tied, at what point is the trust security reached wherein the sexual relationship becomes a gift for the flowering of two people?